This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk.
If you've ever wondered how investment decisions are really made behind the scenes, how experienced investors may disagree, how views evolve, and where judgment matters most, you won't want to miss this episode. This is LNG Talks. I'm Sharka Halla's content manager. Today, I'm joined by Francis Chua, fund manager, and Chris Franklin, investment specialist in our asset allocation team. We're going to unpack what the decision-making process actually looks like in practice. But before we get into it, let's start with something on everyone's mind this month. The World Cup kicks off soon. So who are your favorites? And in your view, what are England's chances this year? Chris, let's start with you.
I would love to say Scotland, given that it's their first World Cup in 28 years and I was born in Aberdeen. But I think at this stage, it's hard to look past France as the overall winners, perhaps beating England in the final. Who knows?
Francis?
Very difficult question to kick us off, I see. So I would say England have got a really good chance, as they always do. They clearly have a very talented team, but a bit like investing, it's less about the kind of prediction, it's about the resilience under kind of stressful environments. So very much hopeful that England will pull it through this year at the World Cup.
Okay, Francis, so you've already set the scene for the discussion ahead. Well, we'll see how those calls play out, but what we're discussing today arguably has more of an impact for our clients. From the outside, asset allocation can appear highly systematic, driven by scenarios, data, and market models. Let's start at the beginning. Francis, what typically triggers a discussion? Is it data, a market event, or potentially emerging differences in view?
It's any of the above, really. On a day-to-day basis, we have processes that ensures that we look at the portfolios, we look at the performance of the portfolio. So that in itself could trigger a discussion. On a day-to-day basis as well, we recap what's been happening in markets, any data points that are likely to come out in markets that, again, could trigger a discussion. So kind of the catalyst for triggering a discussion can be from anywhere. I think maybe a different slant on this or a different way to answer this is, what are we potentially missing? And is there something that we need to do in our portfolios or in our views to reflect new information that has come into our emails or inboxes?
Okay, so let's put this into practice. Once something is on the radar, walk us through the steps between we should discuss this and we're implementing a position. What happens between there?
There's a lot that happens in between in terms of discussion. It can be a very quick discussion, or in some cases, it can be a lengthy, protracted discussion because more analysis is required, or maybe we don't have the right information just yet. What is important to kind of flag at this juncture is that not all discussions will result into position, as you've alluded to. There can be a risk, a bias involved in terms of doing the work and then needing to implement the position just because we've done the work. So we're very disciplined and very cautious that any position that we have has to be justified and has to also be aligned with our overall portfolio and kind of team philosophy. But kind of coming back to your question around what happens in between, it tends to be a multitude of things. We would discuss it, and if we think there are merits to discuss it further, we'll either take it into a separate forum or a separate meeting. Quite often, we will run scenario analysis on the back of it as well. Quite often, we also think about potential trades that may be attached to it as well, and also the transaction costs that may be involved. So there are a multitude of different things that goes into the machine, if you like, or the process of discussing an idea before it gets into a position where we say we're going to implement it and this is how we will implement it in portfolios.
The team often talks about prepare, don't predict. So let's set the scene. There's been a surprise central bank move, a geopolitical event, or a risk-off day. Francis, how do you approach that? Who's involved in these discussions and what kind of perspectives are brought into them?
Everyone. So everyone in the team is participant in meetings. We want to have as much as possible a collaborative environment. In some instances, it may not be necessary or may not be appropriate for everyone to be involved. A good example of that was in COVID. When COVID first broke out, both in the news and both closer to home, it wouldn't be pragmatic from a team perspective, should we say, that everyone would research COVID and try to be the best COVID expert out there. In that situation, we utilized a specialist model where a number of different individuals, specialists to this area were tasked with understanding, modeling, and trying to come up with the best views to try and understand the prevailing condition. But on a more kind of broader sense, there's generally more kind of collaborative environment. Everyone's encouraged and asked to participate in team discussions. And certainly from my perspective as fund manager on a range of multi-asset funds, I'm required to understand the trade-off between risk and returns. And you get a lot of that more than just what is written on email or stored in our databases. You get a lot of that nuance through listening and participating in the discussions.
Chris, let's bring you into the conversation. How do you bring the outside view in, and to what extent do external views shape debate?
They're hugely important. Our investment approach tends not to rely on us being the best forecasters of data or trying to predict with the highest possible degree of accuracy what the next growth or inflation print might be, because that's a really crowded market and there's lots of competitors in the market trying to do that the same thing. Rather, we like to take a step back and look at what are the consensus opinions in markets and the narratives driving those consensus in order to try and identify where there might be frailties or vulnerabilities, which we might look to push against through our active positioning. Or if we do see narratives which we think are really well-founded and unlikely to be broken, then perhaps we may trade with consensus. So with this in mind, understanding what external views are hugely important to our process. And that's why market sentiment, or we call it market dynamics, is one of those seven objective factors against which all our active positions are scored against by our strategists. And so to kind of understand what external views are, we do utilize a lot of inputs. This could be things like traditional news and financial media, sell-side research, as well as high-frequency sentiment indicators. And this is an area which kind of historically has been quite a time-intensive part of our research process. But more recently, we've been able to utilize AI as a tool to help kind of improve the speed and efficiency of our research process. Because as we know, large language models can be really effective at analyzing large amounts of text data and pulling out those key themes and trends. And it's often when we see those large parts of markets saying the same thing that our strategists get excited, because that can be the kernel or the start of an active position or view.
Let's talk about differing views and disagreement. How important is that to the process? If everyone broadly agrees, does that suggest a clear signal, or does that potentially mean that the hypothesis isn't being challenged enough?
So healthy disagreement is an essential part of our process. We want all our investment ideas being subject to challenge and scrutiny before they make it into the portfolios. And this applies beyond just our active dynamic asset class views, but also into the more kind of fundamental construction of our portfolios. And so to foster this challenge, we do want to have an environment in the team where people feel empowered to speak up and also are comfortable changing their minds as the evidence and market data changes. We don't, generally speaking, subscribe to a star fund manager approach or a star strategist. Ultimately, as a multi-asset team, we have a huge amount of resources and asset class specialists that we want to be able to draw upon to make our views. And we think that's essential given that the broad opportunity set that we have as multi-asset investors. If we do have kind of unanimous agreement that comes too easily or too quickly, that can be a bit of a warning flag to us that maybe we need to look deeper and reassess the situation. While debate within the team is often relatively organic, and we have a huge number of talented individuals who are able to weigh into discussions, we do have a number of more formal processes to make sure that scrutiny is always there throughout the investment process. So our investment teams meet daily to discuss market moves, and we also have weekly portfolio meetings where implementation of active views into the funds is discussed. And then finally, we have monthly portfolio meetings where senior leaders in the team will scrutinize the performance and positioning of all our funds against their objectives.
Francis, let's talk about conviction. If conviction is rarely evenly distributed across the team, how do you reflect different levels of confidence in the portfolio?
I love the word conviction. It's a bit like I spend time in my role doing manager research. If you do manager research enough, you find that conviction is a bit like the secret sauce of managers. It's not really written, it's not really kind of visible, but it's evident in the process. So how do we describe conviction? And I think conviction can be thought about in two ways. Number one, it's probably thought best, kind of most commonly thought about in terms of sizing. I think about the more confidence that you have, the larger the sizing. The one drawback with this is that we've seen numerous research that would suggest that the higher the confidence or the perceived confidence on forecasted outcome, actually the less probable the outcome would be. So very mindful of falling to that trap where if we think we've got really kind of high conviction, and kind of to Chris's point earlier, if we think there's a kind of very strong consensus, maybe that's also a data point for us to kind of take a step back and reflect if we've missed something here. The other way to kind of think about conviction for us is really around scenarios. As you say, kind of conviction is rarely kind of evenly distributed. And one of the team's philosophy or mantra is prepare, don't predict. And by that, I mean, we think about a wide range of outcomes, as wide as reasonably possible. Think about it in scenarios. And we debate the relative merits, strengths, drawbacks, trade-offs between each scenario. And why do we do this? We do this because we want to be able to understand the multitude of paths that are available for our portfolios from here on. And we want to make the portfolios as resilient as possible for each of those paths. And as such, there are kind of probabilities attached to it. There's going to be a reassessment as we kind of move along the timeline to understand if any of the scenarios that we predicted had played out as expected, or if not, what did we miss? If there's something else that we need to do. And again, this really comes back into kind of your question around conviction. This then helps us have conviction in our position and sizing, because if we think about the range of outcomes, we're not narrowly targeting one particular outcome. It is more around, you know, let's think about the wide range of probabilities. And that's where I think the real meaning of conviction is around fund management.
Chris, can you wrap this together for us? And building on what Francis has said, how do you take those multitude of paths and unevenly distributed conviction to clients?
So I think it's worth remembering that no action can still be an active decision. And indeed, one of the more difficult decisions to make, especially it feels like over the last few months and even years with the volatility that we've seen in markets, often the right choice can be to do nothing. And yet that can feel psychologically the most difficult. I think another point to make is that much like our diversified approach to asset allocation and building and our kind of desire to build those resilient portfolios that can weather a range of different market scenarios, we also want to be diversified in our active risk taking. So taking active views across different time horizons and asset classes. And by doing so, we're able to bring in the full expertise and kind of specialism of the wider asset allocation team and indeed the wider L&G investment floor.
Francis, what happens when the team genuinely can't reach agreement?
It does happen more often than you think. It may be a different question to try and answer or kind of phrase this or frame this, certainly, is do we try and force consensus? And again, here we can think about the pre and post. Post the discussion, there's definitely kind of consensus in the form of application of views. We want the team to be behind the view. We want the team to support the view, therefore express the kind of funds and portfolios. But before the views form, it's probably anything but consensus. We want as much as possible to have a diverse range of views, challenges, debate. And again, to the point around scenario planning, probabilistic thinking, this is again trying to think about the multitude of scenarios that could play out. And investing is rarely going to be in a straight line. Investing is rarely dependent on one particular factor. It's so multifactorial. And our job is to understand the trade-offs, really, at the end of the day, between each factor. And the best way you can do that is to have a, not anti-consensus per se, but a challenged debate in terms of a view. Does that answer the question?
Yes, that answers the question. Thank you. And Chris, how does the team guard against the risk of the loudest voice dominating discussion?
Yeah, so as Francis has alluded to, we do want those opposing voices in the discussion, and they're really valuable in terms of keeping us intellectually honest and making sure views are as scrutinized as possible. But ultimately, we do have a number of kind of more structural processes that we can utilize to help make sure that certain individuals aren't dominating the overall discussion to an unhelpful extent. So, for example, we do rely a lot on kind of putting our views down on paper. So we make use of written scorecards when it comes to presenting new investment ideas to the team. And this means that whilst we have a lot of really powerful and eloquent communicators in the team, we keep our kind of analysis of the investment views as objective as possible by using these kind of perhaps slightly bland scorecards to kind of keep us focused on the facts and the analysis. Also, in our group discussions, we do rotate the chair of the meeting to help ensure that one individual isn't dominating the conversation and varying that kind of speaking and topic order. We also have this so-called HIPPO rule in effect for many of our meetings, which is this idea that the highest income person's opinion should come towards the end of the meeting, because you want to avoid the so-called anchoring effect, whereby the opinions of senior members of the team can anchor the inputs of more junior members of the team. And so kind of collectively, these are implemented to make sure that we really are getting a broad range of inputs and opinions from the team and maintaining that kind of intellectual diversity.
So that still doesn't account for biases, and everyone has them. What are some of the most common ones that may show up in discussions, and how do you observe the team counteracting them?
Wow, there are so many, so it's difficult to know where to start. As you say, behavioral biases are something that we all suffer from as humans. They're part of our evolutionary history and part of our biology. And they do have the potential to impact us at all stages of the investment process. So, for example, during the idea generation phase, things like recency bias and the framing effect can lead us to rely excessively on recent data points or misweight certain information, depending on how it's presented to us or framed to us. Then later on, once we have active positions on in the portfolio, other biases can come into play. Things like the endowment effect, which is this tendency for humans to overvalue things that they own relative to things that they don't. And so if you think about that in the context of investment risk, it can make closing trades, especially those trades that maybe haven't performed so well, particularly challenging and kind of psychologically uncomfortable. In terms of mitigating against the impact of behavioral biases, we know that just being aware of them isn't enough and kind of can't in itself neutralize their effect. And so it really does come down to process. I've already mentioned some of those things like the HIPPO rule and the use of trading scorecards. Another thing that we do implement with our active views is the use of signposting. So when we are taking a new position in the market, in a new active position, we will often document in quite kind of specific detail what data points, news flow, or events might trigger us to close the trade, review the sizing, or even potentially increase conviction in the trade.
So wrapping up the conversation, what's something investors don't see but should understand about the process? Chris, we'll go with you first.
Yes. So I think one thing that's really important to pull out is the time we spend questioning and reevaluating our kind of active trades and our decisions. We don't do a kind of a set and forget approach to our active view taking. And I say this because we manage our portfolios with really long-term objectives in mind. And so while many of our funds will make use of those tactical and shorter-term views, we also implement much longer-term active positions, which may play out over months, quarters, or even years. A good example of this would be our active position on the AI equity theme, which we've had as a positive overweight within our portfolios since back in 2023. And since then, a huge amount of work has been done to constantly review the investment thesis and the analysis and the evidence for that overweight position to ensure that the kind of fundamental drivers of why we like AI as a market theme continue to be true today as for the same reasons or perhaps different reasons as back in 2023 when we first implemented that view.
Francis?
It's actually a lot to unpack, but if I pick on a few examples, maybe the best reference point or analogy is to think about it in terms of sports, investing and sports. are quite commonly kind of held in the same kind of outcomes-based lens. In sports, you're aiming to be the best team, investing, you're aiming to achieve the best risk-adjusted returns. And both are quite visible. One is through, you know, the score of a particular match, and the other, as you say, is through a fact sheet. But actually, there are many other things that kind of go beneath the surface, which Chris has already touched on. The other ones to kind of point out for us is team structure. We think a lot about the individuals and the collective structure that we bring as part of the process. We're just about to go to our offsite, an annual offsite, and as part of that is, again, a multitude of different exercises to understand how we work together as a team, how we can address some of the blockages in making our work more efficient, but also understanding how we interact together as humans. We've touched on biases. It's almost impossible for us to remove biases unless we kind of plug ourselves to the wall and call ourselves robots. But it's kind of recognizing those biases and recognizing what makes us human and how can we bring out the best out of each other on a day-to-day basis, which is super important, but not necessarily reflected in fact sheets.
Hopefully this conversation has given you a clearer sense of how investment decisions are shaped, not just by data, but by debate, judgment, team structure, and repeatable process. My thanks to Chris and Francis, and thank you for listening to L&G Talks. We'll be back next week with a new episode.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of L&G's Asset Management Division, as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and we're not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general market, economic, or political issues, or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against L&G in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this podcast contains third-party information, the accuracy or completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information, not for distribution to any person in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulations. Copyright 2025. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Unless otherwise stated,